We have a whole bunch of questions that were submitted already. So if you can hear me, I know some of us want to get out. We want to be out of here by 2 o'clock, mainly because you want to get into your backyard. It's a lovely day out there. Let's not waste it here. So this is not wasted. All right, we've got a whole bunch of questions here. The first one submitted by Bilang Wang on the question she raised in class this morning already about the farmers in Africa raising crops for multinational companies and the implications this has for raising food for the locals. My question is, how can we apply the provision of gleaning rights in Deuteronomy to the agreements that the multinationals have with the farmers? It's going to be very difficult, and I'm not sure how, but you've given me a couple of weeks to think about it until we get there at the end of the chapter. But that is an important question. Of course, you have to understand that when the scriptures were written, they had no idea of multinational companies. They had no ideas of computers either. So there are lots of things in which we have to be very creative, in discovering the theological principles underlying the texts that there are, and then transferring those principles into our life. And it's not just modern Western life. If we assume that the scriptures are the scriptures for all people, they have to fit for the Inuits up in Alaska, and they have to fit for the people down in the southern end of Chile, wherever. So, but these are among the questions that we have to ask. So I'm afraid I'm going to defer on that one. If it's all right with you, very apologetically I say that. The second question that came in was, and this is a they're all good questions, but this one is in view of what we did this morning. How does patrilocal practice fit with Genesis, a man shall leave his father and mother? Do we understand patrilocal? Did I use a word that was unfamiliar? Patrilocal means the place of the father. So that when we talk about patrilocal marriage, the female leaves the place of her father and mother and goes to the place of the one who will be the head of the new household. A family is called a Beit Av, the house of the father. So that's patrilocal. How does it... Of course, the text in Genesis says, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. In our day, that word has different connotations than what it did in Old King James. To us, it means to cut something. But there it meant joined. It's the strongest word in Hebrew for crazy glue. Therefore, he shall davak, be welded to his wife. Now, how does one answer this question? And the fact is, that text is the, technical terms, when we run across a word in the Bible that's found nowhere else, we call it a hapax, hapax legomena, a one-time word, never appears anywhere else, and so often you're left to guess. This is a hapax. There is no other text in Scripture that has this kind of, it's always this looks like it's going against the regular direction. The question is, how do we answer it? I have a couple of comments. Sometimes thinking ahead of time helps, sometimes it doesn't. I'm not sure which category this goes. So first, this is the only statement like this in the entire Old Testament, and I would say in the entire Bible. Two, when we read a statement like this, we need to read it in the context of the whole Pentateuch. Genesis chapter 1 and 2 were not written separately, unless, of course, you're in a higher critical scholarly world. Then they say, yes, chapter 2 is written by the J author, and the J author can say stuff that the E author or the P author or the D author, and they just put them all together without reconciling anything. But we don't want to go there. But read it in the whole Pentateuch, and if it sounds strange, sit up and ask, what's going on here? That is not an accident, and there is a sense in which it has to make sense against the pervasive patrilocal and patricentric perspective of the whole business. Third response, there are other texts that seem to declare, what shall we say, contradictions like this. And in Deuteronomy, those of you who were with us a year or two or three or four ago, I have no idea. You remember in Deuteronomy chapter 15, it should be on the left-hand side of the page. Yes, it says in verse 4, however, there will be no poor among you, since the Lord will surely bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Verse 11, for the poor will never cease to be in the land. Therefore, I command you, you shall freely open your hand to your brother. What? Within the same chapter, within 7 verses, he says exactly the opposite. There is another illustration of this. Proverbs 26, you know these verses. 26, verse 4. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will also be like him. But what was verse 5 say? Answer a fool according to his folly. It's one verse right next, and when, I mean, most of the Proverbs are independent little sayings that were collected. Whoever put this together intentionally put them right back to back. So that when we find these apparent, what shall we call them? Antinomies, opposites, whatever. Ask yourself, in what circumstance is this true that the person can say that? And then in what circumstances would the other be true? And then, of course, when we come back to a text like, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, I read a text like Ephesians chapter 5. Therefore, be in subjection to one another. But then he says, wives, be subject to your own husbands. But husbands, what? Love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. So that is this. What's happening in this text is when two people get married, the primary relationship shifts. I should say the primary identity marker. Before we are married, we are identified primarily with our parents. Son of, daughter of, Davidovna, I'm Isakovich, whatever else. You know, that identifies it. But what that text is saying, it's a radical statement saying that you give up the natural relationship into which you're born for the sake of another, and that now becomes your defining. And defining identity, you become one, we could say, new fleshly identity. And I think that's about the way this is going. It is, again, assuming a patricentric world and saying, look, guys, therefore, you cut the apron strings and your commitment to your wife trumps your commitment and responsibility to your parents. I think that's what it is addressing, something like that. All right, where shall we go next? Somebody wants to get me in trouble, but we'll leave that. So far, we have only seen what is to be done if the husband isn't happy with his wife. We've had no discussion about what she can do if her husband is actually abusive or whatever. Did she have any recourse?
Murder.
Murder, yeah. I'm trying to think of biblical illustrations where women take matters into their own hands. 1 Corinthians does talk about the possibility within the context of a mixed marriage, by which we mean one person becomes a believer and the other one not. I think it's chapter 7. There he does talk about these two as two separate, and he addresses each one separately. And the assumption there is that there is certain freedom for people to act. We do have extra biblical texts in which there are records of a woman, walking out on her husband. There is one illustration, it just dawns on me. Judges, this is probably as close as we get now that I think about it. Judges, your favorite book, chapter 19. There was... In those days, there was no king in Israel. There was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah. But his concubine, now your translation, at least mine has, played the harlot, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem. I think it's typical androcentric translation. In this case, I don't think it says played the harlot. The word is actually, in my understanding, she was frustrated with the relationship or irritated or whatever else. I don't think she's playing the harlot. But in any case, she leaves her husband. Remember, she's a concubine. So you have to ask whether the laws of divorce and whatever applied to concubines, but she is a concubine. She goes back to Papa, up in Ephraim. But he goes out and he gets her back. And after spending a week of celebration in his father-in-law's house, the father-in-law, they actually have to extricate themselves from the father-in-law, but they head home in that case. But I think that's as close as we have to... We have no idea what her frustrations are. Is he this kind of ungracious man? Whatever. That's a different... This starts off a chain of events in the business. By the time you're done the story, this Levite is looking very ugly. And I can understand some of it, but right at the front end, you don't have a hint of that. She gets killed because the host sends her out to, and in the end, we don't actually know if maybe her husband did kill her. It's quite ambiguous there. But that arises from a different, what shall we say, sodomite episode in the story. It's very complicated. But the fact that she left suggests that there is some recourse for at least trying to get out. But then he goes after her. And is it as a loyal husband or is it as a power husband? The text isn't quite clear, and by the time the end of the story, we come to the end of the story, I'm quite suspicious of the man anyhow. his impression in my mind does not rise very high.
Would wise Abigail fit that category or not completely? But she certainly lost her husband after making a very wise decision.
Abigail is a problem to me. But at that point, David is a problem to me. For years, Erdmans has been after me to write a book on David. There's so much schizophrenia in that Davidic story, and there's, you know, ethical schizophrenia in Abigail. I have questions about that one. That there's, it is not told in terms of innocence. If you read it with both eyes open, unless you come at it with your Sunday school vision, and by when we are at that stage, everything is glossed over. Everybody's made to look a hero, and you don't spend any time on the negative side. So Abigail, you do have, I mean, there's no way in which women rightly married were mere property. We know that's the case because, and I don't know if we've talked about this, in the biblical world, that which you name, you exercise authority over. Adam names all of the animals. God could have named them, but I think what he's saying to Adam, it's time to be the image. And the image is a representative and deputy of God. Go ahead, name them. So, but when you read biblical texts about naming children, exactly 50% of the occurrences, the mother names the child, and 50% of the occurrences, the father names the child. So, which tells you that it is actually a far more egalitarian world than is often given credit for.
Wouldn't you also say that in the society where everything was in community,
yes,
situations like, you know, abuse within a marriage, things like that, would have been a lot harder to have going on without people knowing it, and perhaps that would have been one of those situations where the whole community is involved in your life, if the whole community sees that he is doing things he ought not to with his wife, they might have taken him to task themselves.
Oh, I think that's that is the right perspective to take on. Remember the text we have about the rebellious son? You don't know what to do with your son, and you've tried everything. Well, then you give him to the elders. The Lord takes it off the parents' hands to deal with them the way the guy deserves, and that's a gracious thing in my view. But the whole community is to be involved, and in that kind of culture, everybody would know, and you live close together. Everybody would know what's going on, and these things would not be hidden. Question. In Deuteronomy, there is concession made to Israel because they were in a culture they were in. That example, ability to take foreign wives after conquest. How can we make Deuteronomy the template for our contemporary society? I think the key to making Deuteronomy the template for our society is hear Jesus. When the rich guy comes to Jesus and asks, what's the great command? What does he say? You shall demonstrate covenant commitment to the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your being and with all your resources, and you shall demonstrate covenant commitment to your neighbor as yourself. That's the way to do it. And what all of these little illustrations are doing is simply giving us examples in life of how to live the big picture. So always keep in mind what's driving the whole thing, the forest, not just the trees. The trees are very particular. Doesn't mean they're irrelevant for us, but it means that in this cultural context, they represent how that big picture principle is to be applied. And it invites us in every age to ask the same questions. So get the big picture. That doesn't mean we don't actually take it literally. I mean, a couple of months ago now, about the when you build a house, a parapet around. It's not hard for us to figure that one out, how that needs to be done in our lives. And we have a moral and heart problem if we fight that command. What's wrong with you that you don't buy into the picture it represents? And so I think we always need to be asking ourselves, what is the big picture of which this is an illustration? And work with that. Chris Wright talks in terms of paradigmatic nature of Israel's laws. They were intended to create a paradigm so that when the world looks at Israel's life and the blessing that comes from God because of their righteousness, they would just get sucked towards that image and want to be a part of this kind of community. So I think basically that's the big the big picture thing. The next couple of weeks we're going to be looking at very particular things, and at every point we're going to have to be asked, well, how is this particular one my scripture? And of course, the common denominator in this chapter 23 is all taking care of those who have trouble taking care of themselves. And once you get that, it's not hard. This is how it would have been done there. There's one on the other side. Isaac blessed Jacob. Balak asked Balaam to curse Israel, but he could not because Israel was already blessed. Today, how do blessings and curses work? Are they current today? Or is it all through prayer to God's will? That's a great question. We can look at blessings magically, mantically, or we can look at blessings as prayers. The magical formula would have it, and there are scholars who do interpret these that way. They assume that the moment you utter words from your mouths, those words have power to transform things. It's virtual magic. So the words themselves have power. I don't think it's exactly that way. There are lots of people who actually think that way, that the words themselves, and that's why they either are very careful with the words they use, or they deliberately use very strong words because they want to have power over people. There are lots of places in the world where these blessings and curses apparently, actually work much this way. When Jacob gathers his sons before him, before he passes away for the great last will and testament, he blesses each of the tribes. And that turns out to be a prophecy. It is not set up merely as human wish words. It is in poetry, obviously inspired by God. People don't normally talk this way in poetry, you know. So, and those blessings were declarations that, prayers to God that God then fulfilled. The best illustration of blessings that I know in everyday life. I mean, the book of Genesis is full of blessings. Some bless each other. Fathers bless their children, whatever. Rebecca's brothers bless her as they send her off with to be the wife of Isaac. So people are blessing each other. But the book of Ruth is a very interesting book, set in the context of the book of Judges when everybody is damning everybody else. Read through the book of Ruth and underline all the blessings. And they come in different forms. The Lord bless you. The Lord be with you. I mean, Boaz comes out to the field and they're mutual blessings. Boaz says to his workers, the Lord be with you. And the workers respond, the Lord bless you. You want a work environment that is healthy? That's it. I worked for a guy for whom it was the opposite. I didn't know what he was going to damn me for when I'd see that pickup coming up. What have I done now? Because there was always something to scold me for. The interesting thing is, in the book of Ruth, there are so many blessings. Boaz says to Ruth, may you be blessed of the Lord under whose wings you have sought refuge. Well, who are the wings? Boaz is the wings. So in that case, Boaz becomes the answer to his own prayer. And of course, that's why by the time you get to the end of the book, the author is so excited. He gives this genealogy. To me, that's the highlight of the book. Boaz begot Obed. Obed begot Jesse. And Jesse begot David! And of course, we from this side of the cross know it's bigger than that David. Because guess who shows up in the genealogy of Jesus? So these blessings are prayers by which the resources of heaven are let loose on a cursed world. If that is true of a blessing, it's probably also true of a curse, though. Which is why these things ought never to be taken lightly. My students notice that I always end my emails with blessings. I do it unconsciously these days. And I was having a telephone conversation with some outfit company. And at the end of the conversation, before I hung up, I said, just bless you. I caught myself and I wondered, what did the person at the other end think of that? But of course, this ought to be our disposition. God called Abraham to be a blessing. And the world ought to see that we are on the side of blessing rather than on the side of curse. And I think that's why blessings and curses are powerful resources, prayer resources, by which the resources of heaven are applied to the needs of earth. That's how I view them. One more here, and this one I didn't see until I stood up here, and that's why I say somebody's trying to get me in trouble. It's not in the form of a question, it's just in the form of a... I'll read it. Existence of life, humans prior to creation, Bible versus science. So, what's the question? I know what the question is. You want to know where I stand on all of that business. And again, like so many other issues, I'm at a place where few people are happy. On the one hand, I get darts on my right side from certain perspective, and on the other hand, I get darts on my left side from certain other perspectives. If you're asking about the existence of life prior to humans, I have absolutely no trouble with that. I leave it to science to tell me how old the earth is. All truth is God's truth, and that's part of God's revelation. And so when I see photographs of stars in the heavens that are 100 million light years away. Well, if it took 100 million light years to get that light to where we are, when was that stuff made out there? You know, so that forces me to allow for a very, very old kind of Earth. But I'm assuming this arises out of this morning's sermon. A passing comment. And I think I know the context out of which that passing comment comes. I'm an agnostic on a lot of things. Not on the existence of God and not on matters of faith and whatever else. I am not an agnostic at all. But I have so, so many questions about origins. And I've got the same kinds of questions about destinies. The absolute past is a mystery to me. And the absolute future is a mystery to me. In the meantime, everything I say about the absolute past and the absolute future is in really soft lead pencil. So don't make me say, read me to say something more dogmatically and emphatically than I'm actually saying it. There was a reference to John Stott's view this morning in the sermon on whether or not Adam and Eve, well, Adam was the first human. And the distinction was made. John Stott, and I know a few other, long before John Stott already, Derek Kidner, one of, in my mind, most esteemed evangelical biblical scholars from the generation of my teachers, he already argued in his little Genesis commentary that it's not necessary to view Adam as the first member of this species. What's necessary is to view Adam as an historical figure. And the person who is first designated the image of God. I know that that view is gaining popularity these days. I'm not there yet. And I don't see how I can ever get there. Because if you do that, then, I mean, Genesis 1 doesn't speak to this issue. It just says God created the heavens and the earth, and God said, let there be all this stuff, and then God said, let's make man, we made man. It doesn't touch on the matter. But Genesis 2 is something quite different. Because in Genesis 2, I mean, you have to, otherwise you have to interpret this merely as some sort of parable, picture, whatever. Some people accuse people who are doing this of saying it's myth. No, that is not necessarily so. But Adam is a paradigmatic figure, a parabolic figure, a type, whatever. But it is quite possible that Adam was not necessarily the first human being. And, of course, arguments these days are brought in with reference to DNA stuff. And not only that, what do you do with all the Neanderthal people? And just this last week, there was another discovery of a jawbone in China that forces us to redate all kinds of other hominid speculations about origins. I have no doubt that these bones that they're bringing out of the ground are real. I mean, I go to the Field Museum every time our grandkids come. We have to go to the... I probably know that place inside and out, and we've only lived here 10 years. But we go at least once a year, sometimes two, whatever. They love that place. But he was 12 at the time, Brennig. Last time we were there with him, he saw this sign there about the explanation of the origins of human beings. And somewhere it said something like everything else, the development of this species is entirely the product of chance. Well, I cannot go there because I think, if anything, the biblical creation story says there's nothing chance here. It is all a very deliberate product of the work of God's hand. But when we get to chapter 2, you have, in my view, a brand new creation. If you want to describe a new creation any other way, I don't know. I can't imagine a picture more graphic and demonstrative. God takes a piece of dirt, whatever that means. He breathes into it his breath, and it becomes a living being. It looks like something new has actually arrived. It's not just that we've made something different out of what already was. So to me, that is an absolute new or beginning. Now, how long ago was that? Just yesterday, I had no idea this was going to come up. I Googled the rabbis to find out when Adam was... No, I was working with the absolute origins of... What's the first date in Israel's history? And I used to think it was the date of the Exodus. That's the date Israel was born. But actually, in Jewish tradition, they don't date it to that. They date the origin of it, or the present date is based on the date of creation. And that date of creation, I've forgotten what the exact thing is. It's... we are now in year 5,680-something. I've forgotten exactly what it is. This is the Orthodox Jewish tradition. And the argument there was, you track the numbers in the genealogies, assuming that they are complete, there are no gaps there. I have problems with that. You track the numbers, and you know how long they were in Egypt, and you know how long it took for them to build the temple, 480 years. And then you know when the temple fell and all, and you can determine very precisely. The best commentary out on the book of Deuteronomy is Jeffrey Teague, and it's a big fat commentary. He's a Jewish. He's not Orthodox. He is either conservative or reformed. But in any case, he's not the far right Orthodox. But if you look at the publication date of that commentary, it's year 5676, I think, something like that. Actually, I think it was 1989 or something like that, our dates. But it's got that year. I have a feeling that we've been around a lot longer than 5,000 years. I have a feeling that the Earth is far older than 5,000 years. The questions in my mind are not, did the Cro-Magnon people live, and did the Neanderthals live, and did the Lucy in Africa live? I can allow that. My question is their relationship to Adam, humanity. And I can allow for the existence of other hominids, if by hominid you mean... human-like person. But that does not, in my view, does not necessarily mean that they are genetically related. And the DNA evidence, I think, is still, in my view, I'm not a scientist, some of you know far better, far too sketchy, and you have to make far too many leaps to draw the kinds of conclusions people are drawing these days. I think not only was Adam an historical figure, I think he was the first member of our species. I'm a fundamentalist, aren't I? So that's where I am. Like Luther says, here I stand. I can do no other. But again, it's in soft lead pencil. The point is, in all of our interpretation, both of the scientific data and of the biblical data, we need to be humble and we need to interpret it as it's intended to be interpreted. And with further light, we might be driven both to read science differently. All it takes is one more discovery and they have to burn the whole library and rewrite all the books. It doesn't take much. I know how this works in the archaeology and the Bible kind of stuff. I mean, for years they were saying never, Belshazzar, the king in Daniel, that's a mythical figure. It's a made-up story till all of a sudden they discover three texts in which the guy's name shows up. Now you have to go and rewrite all those books because, you know, he's a real dude. And on this one, too, I mean, we're just scratching, and the dots are still light years apart, and we're doing the best we can to connect the dots. And I won't quibble with data, either biblical or other biblical. We can't quibble with data. We can quibble with interpretation of the data, and that's our problem. And until the Lord comes again, we will be doing those kinds of things. And if it's not this question, it'll be another one. So I don't know. Does that answer the... Whoever asked it, did I get myself in real trouble? Fighting funding? You understand from that I'm not a young earth guy. I'm not troubled by young earth people. I don't understand them. But on the other hand, I mean, I used to be there. On the other hand, I don't buy all the other stuff that people are doing. So it's an awkward place to be. People on both sides say, stop compromising. Get a backbone. No, I can't. Any other question? That's it. That's all I have here. Or did I miss one? Is it about the worms or the can?
I'm afraid it's a comment.
Pardon me. It's
a comment. We keep forgetting that Genesis was written to someone at least 1900 BC.
Exactly.
If God had decided to write to us so that we would understand it with science in 2000 BC, we're forgetting the fact of what you just said, that another day it might all change.
Yep.
And so it had to be written in terms of what the understanding of someone 1900 BC could understand, and then we have to take it from there.
Yes, that is so true. I think at that point we also have to say it had to be written in such a way that for future generations it didn't take them off course. I think that's important because this is a presuppositional thing, if we accept that God never lies, or he never makes a statement that proves to be untrue and that he has to pull back, then we have to say something like that. If it doesn't seem to make sense, then that lack of sense is in my head, not in the text. Sanctified knowledge is the... Exactly. Here.
I have a statement to make regarding the place of the woman, I think that was a question or two behind. I work with a doctor who is a rabbi, and I have a lot of fun with him. I have more fellowship with him than anybody. But I always go to him and I'll say, Doctor, in Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 6, and then he'll stop and say, okay, Herr Schmutzer, I got it. Go ahead. I don't even have to tell him what the verse is. He knows. We brought up this thing of giving a wife a certificate, a get.
And, a get, exactly.
And he said...
The Yiddish word for it.
Yeah. He said, in old Germany or old Europe, before the war, he said, if a man did not give a get to a woman whom he was divorcing. That woman was absolutely hopeless or helpless in any way. She could never get a job. She would never remarry. She was absolutely worthless in society. Mm-hmm. But he said there was an alternative to that. She would go to a group of women who he said were like vigilantes. And they were a group of women whom she could go to and make her plea.
Yeah.
And then when they caught this guy some night, they would beat him up and tell him that this was what's going to happen until she got her get. And he said that's the way the women in that era solved that problem. And I thought it was pretty good.
It's a strong-willed group.
Earlier you mentioned, you said a few things about the genealogy of Jesus, and that brought back to mind a conversation I had with a Catholic friend around Christmas time. I was talking about the genealogy through Joseph, and he kind of challenged me and said, well, why is that significant since, you know, Joseph isn't, you know, wasn't really Jesus' natural father? Mm. And I tried to give him some answers, which I guess weren't convincing, and I just wonder what you might say about that.
That's a great question. It's probably not unrelated to the problem in the book of Ruth. Remember, in the book of Ruth, the problem is Elimelech has died and his two sons have died and the family's about to die out, cut off. May your seed die out and your name perish. That's about to happen. Boaz says expressly he is marrying Ruth to preserve the estate of Elimelech and to preserve the family. Well, according to the custom of the day, this is bending the rules of levirate marriages, but according to the rules of the according to the custom of the day, the first child of that offspring would be legally viewed the child of the deceased man, either Elimelech or Mahlon, Ruth's actual husband. Now, as it turns out, Obed is born, and he is physically Boaz's child, but I thought we were setting him up to be the son of Elimelech via Mahlon. But when you read the genealogy at the end, it doesn't mention Elimelech at all, nor does it mention Mahlon. It mentions Boaz, Obed, Jesse, and David. So there you already have within the book, if I use a word like violation, that sounds too negative, but a suspension of the custom, this person becomes, is legally and physically viewed as Boaz's son, which makes fiction out of his high-sounding determination to preserve the previous family. So there you have it already. Elimelech should have been there. Now, in the case of Joseph, you've got actually the opposite happening. Joseph is the one in line. This is my understanding of the Matthew genealogy. The line of descent comes via the line of authority. The function of what we call a linear genealogy, as opposed to tree-segmented genealogy, the function of a linear genealogy is to show the link between the first person and the last person. That's the point. As opposed to giving a family tree, table of nations, whatever. But here, the first person is Abraham, David, Jehoiachin. Those are the three critical features. The Christ. The point is, How does Jesus relate to Abraham? This is a short course in history, and it comes via Joseph, which is really, but also Boaz. Now, when you go to the Luke one, there are differences. And so, you know, I'm not a New Testament scholar, but my superficial view is that there you may have the genealogy taken through Mary. I don't know. But in any case, this is a problem for Jewish people and how we read that genealogy. It's fiction. Jesus' Davidic descent is fiction. Unless, of course, the Luke one. But I don't think it needs to be fiction, even if the Luke one is a variation of Joseph's genealogy. If Joseph himself, there's no reason why Joseph himself could not have been a descendant of David just as well as Mary, you know, so that works as well. It's not like he's an outsider to this line. But I don't know. It's a tough one. One more question. We can do that.
You mentioned earlier that the naming gives the authority to the person who does the naming.
Uh-huh.
And this is not to disagree with that, but I wonder if you see in God asking Adam to name the animals something else. It says in the narrative that God said first, it's not good for the man to be alone. And then it interrupts it with the naming of the animals.
Exactly.
And then it says, but for Adam there was no helper suitable for him.
Right.
And then when God finally makes Adam, makes Eve and brings her to Adam, and he goes, aha,
Eureka!
At last.
Yes.
Yeah, this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. So I'm wondering if God was using the discovery method, his own, Adam's own discovery, that that's got to be something else. And that it becomes so ingrained in his consciousness that Eve is bone of his bones. And
well, I think there are at least four or five things going on here. One, put yourself in Adam's shoes. The Lord had, or the text had just said, the Lord made all of this stuff in the garden for people to delight in. The fruit and the trees and whatever. So I think this is a purely, shall we say, recreational and entertaining afternoon for Adam. The Lord brings all the creatures in front of him and says, look at this, isn't that fabulous? You know, we like going to Cosley Zoo or Brookfield or whatever. Here's the zoo comes to him. And I think it gives him a chance to enjoy God's creation. So that's at the recreational level. But also at the, shall we say, intellectual level. The assumption is that what you call somebody, something, is significant. So that the call to name the animals is not just to exercise power. It is also to engage in scientific exploration. And so that when the camel comes in front of you, then God asks, well, Adam, what are you going to call that? And he'll say, I'll call it a camel. Why are you going to call it a camel? It looks like a camel. Or whatever. I could say it's a horse designed by committee, but that assumes polytheism of some sort. You know, so this is an intellectual, a part of being the image of God is learning creation, what drives it, the curiosity. So there's that level. But then I think the primary thing is the social level. It is not good for man to be alone. So God parades all of these creatures in front of Adam, inviting Adam to pick the helper suitable. I think the best way to translate it is the counterpart for himself. And every time a critter comes by, he has to cross it out. The snake won't work. I mean, the sheep won't work. The alligator won't work. It's a frustrating day. So at the end of the day, it really isn't good. It's not good for Adam, and it's not good for the future of the cosmos, because you're supposed to fill the earth, and Adam says none of these will work. I mean, Adam can't do it by himself. He's not androgynous or hermaphroditic, whatever word we use for. There are creatures that are, but we're not. Male and female, he created them. And so Adam had to say that none of these other critters works. And it's a frustrating day. And so that is all intended to highlight the creation of the woman as the highlight of creation. So that if Adam is appointed to be king of this garden, she is a specially created queen. It's not just one of the critters. She is there as his counterpart and equal. And I think that's why he says at the end, "Eureka, I found it, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. This is the one." And so he got it. So the day ended well. It was not good for man to be alone. Some of us have said that too.
And that's a great place for us to end today too. So thank you, Dan. And thanks to all the questioners and cooks and everyone. Eric is going to close us in prayer.
Please join me in prayer. Father, we thank you for this Lord's Day that we can gather for worship here. Thank you for College Church. Thank you for the Veritas class. I thank you for calling us to community that we can fellowship and enjoy food and learning your word. We thank you that for these weeks and years we've been looking through the Old Testament, through Deuteronomy, and seeing that it's about gospel. And we thank you for giving us the gospel, as Moses taught it, but through Jesus Christ. We thank you for Christ in the gospel. We pray that as we go out from here this day, that we would be encouraged by the gospel, that we would live in light of the gospel, and that we would be sharing the gospel with our friends and neighbors, especially as we look to these weeks before Easter. And so go with us now and dismiss us with your grace, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.